All right, Zero Books viewers and readers, hopefully. I'm here with Derek Varn. We're going to do Pop the Left today. At this time, we're talking about the dictatorship of the proletariat. But before, somehow, let me add him back to the stream. Somehow he got lost there for a second. Before we do that, though, Derek, I want to give you a chance to come at me because yesterday I sort of came at you when we were having a disagreement on Facebook. I got all miffed and sent you swear words through direct messenger. So I want to give you an opportunity to respond in person now. Maybe we can discuss what we were discussing before, which was, I guess, the revolutionary potential of the riots that are happening now in response to the murder of George Floyd.
The funny thing is, I thought you took the wrong tone, but I actually thought your essential statement was correct. Riots are only a precursor to a revolutionary movement if there's a clear organization for them to funnel into. Like, there were bread riots that led to, you know, the uprisings in Russia. But there were also political parties that have been built for, you know, political parties, secret unions, all kinds of different organizations that have been built by various groups for two decades before that happened.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things I think people are avoiding, though, in the implications of the question is, why are we having these riots again? We've had them, with the exception of the aughts, for reasons that aren't clear to me, about every 5 to 10 years.
I think there was one in 2009.
Yeah.
There's two questions. One is, why are the riots continuing? And the other, I guess, flip side of that question is, why is it that the U.S. police is unable to be reformed so that these kinds of incidents don't happen, or don't happen on the frequency that they have this kind of political or social effect?
Right. So your unpopular opinion is that, these riots aren't revolutionary. My unpopular opinion is they're actually an indication that the second phase of Black Lives Matter, when it became more institutionalized and formal, largely failed.
Obviously that goes without saying that the aims of Black Lives Matter were not achieved. Although, you know, we can debate what those aims actually ultimately were, but.
Right. Well, the thing is, if the demands were social change, I will say that, like, everybody, even more than with Eric Gardner, is paying lip. I mean, even the Fraternal Organization of Police is condemning this killing, which is unheard of.
Trump is condemning it.
Right. So the social scale has in some ways moved, you know, to support the least sentiment that inspires the rioters.
Eric Garner case was universally condemned as well. I mean, I don't remember anyone of any political persuasion looking at that and saying it was anything other than just, at the very least, second degree murder negligence.
Yeah, criminal negligence.
Criminal negligence and manslaughter. It's the word I was looking for.
Right.
At the very least, it was manslaughter. This looks more like just out and right murder. You know, not premeditated, but in whatever degree it would be, where it's like a crime of passion. The racial motivation probably can't be ignored here. It would be possibly a hate crime as well. Right. And by U.S. law. So this guy was targeted for and murdered partly due to his race. I mean, none of this can be avoided. So my point by saying that the riots weren't revolutionary was not to condemn the riots. It was just to say people who are getting excited that the riots indicate some sort of coming together of radical forces, I think, are misguided. I don't think that they do.
Well, It would indicate that there's some kind of frustration that would lead to will, but the fact that it's manifesting specifically as a riot, and that there was no appeal to, you know, kind of the institutions that were built out of BLM. I mean, like, I literally 2 days before this happened shared an article about Sean King and the hemorrhaging of money over at the North Star. Mm-hmm.
Is North Star back?
Different North Star.
Okay.
So Sean King started a BLM-inspired progressive caucus sort of organ called the North Star, and apparently it's been hemorrhaging money and there's been all kinds of scandal about accounting for that money, and it's not been right wingers pushing that scandal. It's been former staffers. Mm-hmm. And so what this indicates to me is, like, I remember I was talking to you about this a few years ago, and I listened to Black Lives Matter activists who got a law degree from the university in the state I live in, and I'll be vague about that, even though everyone knows what it is. And they were invoking the Panthers while also talking about diversifying the FBI and the local police force. Now, even from a perspective of, say, the Maryland riots, which, you know, were heavily tied into BLM, I don't understand why anyone would have ever thought that was an appropriate path to go down, because the Maryland police force is plenty diversified. Ferguson was rare in that the police force was so white, but most police forces in the South are majority minority because most of the areas are. And that,
yeah, I mean, I think there have been some studies done that show that if you're looking to overcome the disparities in police violence aimed at Black men, particularly, you're not going to find it by putting more people of color and even Black people onto the police force, because the doesn't turn out that cops are less likely to be violent against Black men if they're themselves Black, which, I mean, it's not too surprising because we're talking about a structural disparity here. The racism is not just coming up in the individual's consciousness. And you can probably also find racist thoughts in Black people's heads too, right?
Yeah, I mean, yeah. I mean, there's plenty of studies of internalized racism, and I mean,
but the real foundation for overcoming police brutality like this has to be lifting up the people in those communities which are most policed,
right? And removing. I mean, someone pointed out that policing people of color and poor people and poor people of all races really. Mm-hmm. Has to do with the fact that they are actually hyper-regulated in ways that you just aren't when you move up the class scale. And coming from a person who grew up in a kind of poor inner city neighborhood and then moved to the exurbs, I can, like, observe that easily. Like, I hardly ever saw cops on the better side of town.
Yeah. So we ended up yesterday really going at it at least a little bit in the DM.
Yeah, I won't repeat what I called you.
You called me a class traitor.
I called you a class traitor. No, I called you a class enemy several times.
Class enemy. And my response to that was, yeah, if Derek Varn is a class to himself, then I'm a class enemy.
And then we talked it through because I was responding more to the idea that that we were rehashing an old discussion about the revolutionary force of riots or whatever from like 68ers. What you convinced me of is that, well, a lot of people do seem to think that this is an indication that the needle's really shifted. People thought that
After Ferguson, they thought that after the Rodney King riots, people have been thinking that these riots are going to have a positive influence on politics for a long, long time. Guy Debord wrote about the Watts riots as a symptom of, and as a sign of radical struggle for emancipation, you know, an inchoate but nonetheless real struggle to overcome the commodity form, he said at the time. And yeah. I just think that that was probably wrong then, and it's certainly wrong now. And that doesn't mean that I'm sitting in judgment on, like, I don't expect everyday people to be sitting around going, oh, am I overcoming the commodity form, before they go out and rage after a police murders someone, right?
Yeah. And, right. And to be very clear, you don't care that anyone burned a Target either. But like,
no, I don't care. I don't care about that either way, right? But what I do care about is when people on the left convince themselves that something's happening for them that isn't happening. It's not about the people who are rioting. It's about the left's desperation to take any form of resistance to be an indication that there's some progress going on.
Not to defend the position, but to get to why I think it's so appealing, it's because particularly after the Bernie, you know, electoral parliamentary, let's play nicey nice with progressives, you know, riots aren't liberal. They aren't really anything, you know, they're impotent. They're impotent rage manifested, you know, where they're not that impotent anymore.
I mean, again, on their own, they're that. They could be a part of a violent strategy, a strategy to use violence for political ends, right?
Right.
Right. They could be that.
But, I mean, if you combine riots and strikes and strategic shutdowns and, you know, certain kinds of confrontations, you know, that's an insurrection. Even that may not be, you know, revolutionary. But
someone asked the question for $2. This is the name of the game here. Throw in a couple bucks and we'll interrupt ourselves. But we will be taking questions from everybody without a super chat later on, after we've actually talked about the topic. But what role has organized labor been playing in Minnesota?
You know, I don't know. I suspect, frankly, probably not a lot. I mean,
the question is, like, since the murder of George Floyd, I would imagine none.
Right. But
overall in their politics, you know, I don't know. Do you have any clue as to what's going on?
Well, Minnesota. I know, like, the teachers union in Minnesota is, like, a lot more radical than, say, the teachers union where I live, but it's, I think they've been trying to halt the Wisconsinification of their state.
Mm-hmm.
But I also think, if I remember looking at the Twin Cities, you know, stats, I don't think most of those workplaces are anything close to unionized. And unfortunately speaking, union jobs right now in the United States are not associated with inner city poverty.
Is that because of automation? In other words, that so much of the real productive work has been concentrated down to very small sectors of the economy?
Well, sort of, but you also have the fact that, like, a lot of the, like, automotive production, for example, in so much that it exists in the United States, is now largely in the South, out of union areas. But there's also the fact there was real, like, and I know it's uncool on left circles to talk about this, but there's real anger at the unions, particularly in the period from the 90s to the late aughts, as basically just being a fundraising platform for the Democrats. Mm-hmm. And not getting anything back for that, like, that they were basically a captured body, and because of their seniority rules, didn't really try to make themselves attractive to newer members. Plus, there's, you know, but yeah, I think a lot of it's that the kind of work that's in the inner city is not work that currently lends itself to unionization, and if it is unionized, it's unionized at, like, small franchise levels, not in the level of the industry.
Let's move to the topic, the official topic, which is the dictatorship of the proletariat. I mean, I'm if I'm remembering correctly, that's what we agreed upon.
Yeah, we agreed upon the dictatorship of the proletariat. We were also talking about It's going to come up today, like the dictatorship, the proletariat, the withering of the state, because this is all related, actually.
Yeah.
And then as a hint, we might talk about Grossman.
Yeah.
And maybe even end notes. I don't know. We had a lot come up this
yeah,
week.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I was
before we yelled at each other.
Right. Right. Which was, you know, basically you were tone policing me on my Facebook wall.
And I was tone policing you, and I
wanted and maybe I somewhat deserve that because I was on Twitter before I posted that. So obviously I was having some sort of emotional reaction to Twitter. And it's always a good idea to walk away from the screen before you subtweet on your Facebook wall. Is that what that would be?
Yeah.
about well, some shit I mean, on Twitter.
You're not the only person that has told me that they're worried about people thinking every riot is somehow communism. Like, it's actually come up with some people who normally are very supportive of this kind of thing. They're just also like, we, you know, I've lived through this four times now, and they're way younger than us.
Right. Right.
So, like, I mean, I wish I thought it was. I mean, hell, I wish I thought this would actually lead to police reforms. And one of the things that you know, maybe we should point out to people for this is in the United States, representation does not mean much. You are a captive. You are more beholden to what represents you than the other way around, mm-hmm. which means they don't really represent you. They actually are a form of domination. So, like, for all the fact that even on some conservative circles, things have moved at least formally leftward on police brutality, it doesn't change anything because the social impetus doesn't affect the political calculus that much at all.
I just want to put something on the screen here. If Vaughn and Lane aren't fighting, then something is amiss. So we have a long tradition of fighting.
I mean, we haven't blocked each other over Hegel in several years.
But. Yeah, many years. Yeah, no, and I decided last night that I would just swear a lot that would clear my system, and then we could talk. But okay, all right, let's talk about the dictatorship of the proletariat now, because I think that this is the segue into this is if rioting isn't socialism, what is, and do we need to take state power in one way or another to create this dictatorship of the proletariat to usher in the first phase of communism or socialism?
Yeah, whatever. we'll talk about that too. But the dictatorship of the proletariat from Marx to Lenin by Hal Draper, and Hal Draper's Marxist Revolutionary Theory, Volume 3, The Dictatorship of the Proletariat, which is summarized in this book in like 20 pages, but is actually like 400 pages long. So-ish. So those are the two books I'm pulling from for this. Also just going through Marx's readings. Cause one of the things I notice about Marx is when he talks about the dictatorship of capital, are other socialists acting like dictators? Or when he critiques, Blankism and Bakuninism and even Paul LeBlanc. I keep on making Paul.
Yeah,
LeBlanc, the French socialist. He points out their dictatorial tendencies.
I'll be right back, but keep going because I know what you're saying, and I want to close the curtain so that I'm not backlit.
Okay,
I'll be right back.
No problem. So when I actually started reading this, I was surprised that Marx uses dictator in almost all other instances negatively. And meaning something more like what we mean by it now, which is like an authoritarian personality dominating. And he was really resistant to it. One of the reasons why, you know, we talked about how he praised LaSalle at his death. But one of the reasons why he didn't have his people work with LaSalle at first when LaSalle was alive was LaSalle's dictatorial tendencies within the labor movement he was starting, even though, you know, LaSalle was doing it supposedly in Marx's name, and his fear, which posthumously we discovered was justified, that LaSalle would turn to Bonapartist methods to secure stuff for the working class. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he was willing to make major concessions to Bismarck to, you know, hold power. So that, you know, so again, so when you think about the dictatorship of the proletariat, that doesn't make sense. It's not in line with that. Then you have the classical constitutionally limited role of what a dictatorship was. A dictatorship in the Roman constitution was a brief period where one figure would assume power mm-hmm. to save the constitution itself. Now, ironically, you know, this led to Caesarism and ultimately the undoing of the Roman Republic. But it's interesting that it was noticeably necessary in times of crisis. The dictatorship of the proletariat, Marx, seems pretty clearly to be that the proletariat can't be represented by anyone or even by a minority mm-hmm. within itself. It has to be represented and assume control, similar to the way the legal regime of the bourgeois kind of dominates everything in capital, despite popular opinion and despite the fact that, at least in most capitalist countries now, if we define proletariat as those dependent on the wage fund, or even those without property, they would be a democratic majority.
Right.
So you know, how does capital maintain power? The variety means we all know that. But so you have to seize the mechanism of the state to freeze those things, because those rules have been written, you know.
Right.
As a means of class power.
Right. And that means that during a revolutionary moment, there will be a state of exception.
Right.
Almost invariably. I mean, we can dream about electoralism. But it's likely that even if we gain power through the vote, that the kinds of changes we'd want to institute would be at times considered to be by many and argued to be unconstitutional.
Right.
For instance. So there'll be states of exception. But so I understand that this sort of a taking of political power, in a state of emergency, creating a state of exception. But the dictatorship of the proletariat has been transformed from that idea into the idea of this what it is to be socialist, or what socialism is. In other words, socialism is equal to a period in which the state is workerist and there is a dictatorship of the proletariat. That's what a lot of people believe.
Right.
And I don't think that's what Marx was arguing. I think Lenin sort of had it both ways.
Yeah. Because Kautsky had it both ways. Kautsky, when arguing with Lenin, actually ends up accepting Lenin's definition, which comes into this. What's interesting about this book is that the most crucial fight for this is actually Engels versus Plekhanov, because Engels thought the dictatorship of the proletariat and the democratic republic were actually going to be the same thing. And, you know, so that we don't get that as clearly stated in Marx. And maybe because Marx was ambivalent on it, there is like notes in the economic manuscripts of, I forget which ones, where Marx says that communist, something like communist rule could happen either democratically or autocratically as far as the abolishment of value is concerned.
Right. Yeah.
But he obviously was afraid of, you know, what anarchists and even some like left oppositionists and left communists would consider the new class forming from a bureaucratized state functionary.
I don't think that if you overthrow the value form and create a conditions and where by, I mean, you can overthrow the value form by regressing, right? I mean,
right.
At least theoretically you could, but if you're overthrowing the value form and replacing it with something like a classless form of production where people have equal access to or and control over the means of production. The property relations that set up production now are abolished, and people are competing to be productive rather than for consumer goods. Mm-hmm. If you create that situation, I don't think you could create a new bureaucratic class that you need to worry about. It's only when you have not overturned the value form that that kind of manifest that would manifest as a threat.
So what I find interesting in Draper, at least in the first part of this book and in volume three of Marx's Theory of Revolution, is Draper actually discusses this development in three waves after they're all kind of in response to the various failures of the left side of the French Revolution. The first thing that kind of scares Marx, though, and Marx talks about LeBlanc's call with the liberal and the bourgeois government before, you know, 1848 degenerates into the rule of the Party of Order, and then the Party of Order degenerates into the rule of Louis Napoleon, for an educational dictatorship. All right. Ironically, the most, you know, pink marbled of socialist, LeBlanc, whose, you know, idea of socialism is basically a workhouse. It's like MMT Lite, thought that a re-educational dictatorship was necessary to put before you could have a vote, because the working classes and the peasant classes and the sans-culottes were all too uneducated to vote properly and might go reactionary. And so we needed an educational dictatorship.
Yeah. I mean, it sounds like basically that sounds like what you'd hear in an activist meeting at the bar.
Right.
People secretly believe that kind of shit. Yeah. I mean, obviously, that's not a Marxist perspective. It doesn't have, but I mean, I do think that one of the roles of a dictatorship of the proletariat, or the one of the things that state management might be able to provide workers in a time of transition would be maybe some technical training or some assistance.
Well, I mean, when Marx talks about this in the critique of the Goethe program, and I mean, we'll get into whether or not that's an imminent critique later. Mm-hmm. He does talk about, like, the state shouldn't run education, but should certify, like, who's actually skilled enough to teach so charlatans don't take over.
Yeah.
Which, again, often surprises people. But he also didn't think, I mean, he did think that education should be free and socialized, but not necessarily run by the state.
Yeah.
So what does that mean? Well, that's, you know, socialization as opposed to just nationalization is like always kind of a big issue in Marxist circles. And almost all Marxists since the 20s have kind of treated socialization and nationalization as the same thing, despite Engels' letters to Kautsky that they weren't.
Yeah. This was something that I had a blowout with a fellow Zero Books comrade about several months ago, whether or not Marx meant, you know, something would become property of the state when he talked about socialization.
Mm-hmm.
Marx thought that capitalism was a force for socialization.
Right. That it socialized
production. Yeah. It brought people together to do mass projects of production when they had been working on their own land privately before.
As opposed to bringing it out of fairly deracinated artisans and peasants guild, like and peasants cooperatives, like.
But he wasn't. So when he talked about socialization, you know, it had multiple meanings depending on the context. But it was never just a matter of state control.
Right. It's. I think it's confused because the nationalization of certain industries is called for in the Communist Manifesto, but. When you read stuff like the Brumaire, in the Brumaire, he's actually calling for the abolishment of taxes and stuff. Like and the reason why is he starts to see the state as a class organ. Now, Marxists actually, particularly in the 20s and 30s, during, you know, it actually really messed them up, started seeing the state as a class neutral organ, which could be control by whomever parliamentarily, this was the explicit reformist reading of monopoly capital from Hilferding. And all right, so in the 1920s, they thought that the state was a class neutral organ.
These weren't Leninists who were saying this, though.
I mean, actually, interestingly, Hilferding is who inspires Lenin, but with his monopoly capital theories. But Lenin and Hilferding actually come to opposed politics based on how they interpret the meaning of it. What Hilferding eventually does is say monopoly. You know, they take the second international position and the first international position. The development of capital increases socialization, and that monopolies, even though they have certain inefficiency problems and fragilities, would actually develop all the means that you need for, you know, you just have to democratize the running of the workshops because they had so monopolized that you could do that. So it's a mixture between social democracy and like syndicalism, except it was also in a kind of Bernsteinian progressive progressive capitalist move, whereas Lenin read the same things and thought that it would lead to more imperialism because of the need for more and more profits because monopoly is not a highly profitable system because of the decline in competition, leads to all kinds of inefficiencies. There's no place for the labor market to go, et cetera, and so forth. So,
I want to reframe this a little bit because there's an organization I used to be a part of called the Platypus Affiliated Society.
Yes.
One of their major claims is that Marx's most significant contribution to socialism was his discovery of the need for the dictatorship of the proletariat. This is a line you would hear often if you hung around in Platypus Affiliated Society groups. Mm-hmm. I think that Marx actually said something like that in a letter at one point.
Thought
it was his most significant contribution.
Right. And I know you think it's value form abolition. And I think if you look at the theoretical undermining of capital and its historical development, it is value abolition.
Yeah, I don't think the dictatorship of the proletariat makes any sense if you don't understand what he meant to be connected to. His understanding of the need to transform the mode of production, which had to do with getting rid of the value form. Because what the dictatorship is for is to provide the authority and protection that the workers needed in their revolutionary project of transforming society, which would take place in the realm of production first.
Right. Well, I mean, yeah, of course. So the issue with the dictatorship of the proletariat is that it's tied into Marx's theory of the state. And Marx's theory of the state is probably the absolute most vague part of Marxism, partly because it's not fully articulated. Mm-hmm. One thing you have to deal with, and it's something I've been struggling with because, you know, my fundamental text when it comes to like the clarifications of Marxism, and actually Hal Draper, again, brings it up in this book. One of the discussions of the dictatorship of the proletariat's importance, it actually re-entered the debate between Plunkinoff and Engels over the finally publishing, after it was no longer relevant, the critique of the Goethe program.
Mm-hmm.
If you take the stance as, maybe Paul Matique, definitely... Nick Rogers, that the critique of the Goethe program is an immanent critique, meaning that it's using a lot of the categorical separations made by Lassallians and other social democrats as its framework, then understanding like the dictatorship of the proletariat is actually still very clarifying, but it leads to kind of some issues. One is like if you have like a multi-stage theory of state withering away and it's not gradual but discrete, like there's this stage and then at this discrete stage we do this.
Yeah.
Then it's harder to know like what the limits to the dictatorship of the proletariat are and what it actually is. If you take the view that a lot of people who've studied, you know, Marxology, Draper's also pointed this out too, that in most other places when Marx writes about socialism and communism, they use them interchangeably, remark that they use them interchangeably and only change the terms based on who they're more closely allied with, be it French socialist or British charterist and communist. Mm-hmm. And so the terms is largely interchangeable. Mm-hmm. And they're not clear, distinct points. And even in the critique of the Goethe program, you and I have talked about this, even if you don't think it's an imminent critique, like there is not a clear, distinct marker between lower stage socialism, higher stage socialism, and communism. It's just not there.
In the critique of the Goethe program.
Yeah, in the critique of the Goethe program. And in all the others, there's no distinction made at all.
Right. I would have to say that it seems to me very, very likely that Marx was launching maybe a not entirely consistent, but mostly consistent imminent critique of the Goethe program. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you read it, that's what he's doing. He's going line by line, taking this each sentence, trying to figure out what the meaning of it is, right? And what problems are in it. He's not saying, as you might, if you were debating a utility theorist, you know, somebody who's like a Austrian school economist, you might just start with, your whole concepts are wrong, your definitions are wrong, and mm-hmm. these are the right ones. If that's not what he does, he would say, well, tell me about your theory of prices. And how does, you know, right. That would be the imminent critique. I mean, let's look at what you're saying about prices and see whether or not it holds up.
Right.
Actually, what I tried to do with Stefan Molyneux, which right. I think a flop, but but anyway, go ahead.
Well, I mean, the reason why that probably works in the case point of the Goethe program is it's a political program, not a rhetorical debate. But yeah. The other thing is, like, when I read the Goethe program, the distinction between communism and socialism isn't really there either. My only point is, there, if you have this idea that there are several discrete stages, and I think even Draper thinks that maybe Lenin misread this, and I know Rogers does, as does another Marxist scholar, Eric Ries, who points out that that at the very minimum, even if you accept that Marx held to the critique of the Goethe stage theory, that mm-hmm. he thought the withering away of the state was almost immediate during the dictatorship of the proletariat. That one of the things that you do is to assume the dictatorship so that the functions of the state can be picked up by other organs within society, controlled by those who produce those organs. Who produces those organs? The proletariat. Mm-hmm. Why does it have to be a dictatorship? Because the rules were written by the people who set up the current society. So, of course, it's set up to favor them. They created the game in which you play in. So even if you accept
my kids at the door, but keep going for a second, Greg.
So you have to fade this out pretty quickly.
All right, repeat that last bit because I was talking about sodas with my kid. Say that last bit again.
Oh, I said you have to fade out. You have to fade out the state fairly quickly. Otherwise, the dictatorship of a proletariat is a new form of state.
Yeah, exactly. So look, to say all this about, I mean, so we're basically both of us taking this sort of position that Nick Rogers took in his essay, Lenin's Misreading of Marx, which was written in February of last year, or at least published then, in the Weekly Worker. We're both sort of taking that position. But even if you take that position, that doesn't mean that by claiming the dictatorship of the proletariat is a is itself the organ by which the state will wither away, right? Mm-hmm. Which I think what we would say, like, that is, it is the way that the proletariat will seize power and destroy the state. In fact, even if you believe that, that still leaves a lot of problems for Marxist revolutionaries to solve. I mean, we're not really solving much of anything except by stating, here is our goal. I mean, here's where we're framing what the problem is. The problem is not gaining state power. The problem is gaining power over the material basis of life and transforming society so that the state is no longer necessary. I mean, that's we know that much. But now the question would arise, you know, well, is that even what does that make sense to people? Is the working class ready to take on that kind of responsibility and creative endeavor? And can that kind of creative endeavor be done through a violent revolutionary struggle? I mean, isn't the very fact that this will be a moment of crisis and a moment of violence sort of set in opposition to the aim, which is emancipation and the freeing up of creative power? Mm-hmm. I mean, these are still major problems for Marxism, I think. And they're not problems that can be solved only by doing podcasts. Some of it has to be solved in action. But they should be debated and, you know, theorized about. And there are lots of risks that come up, you know, like there's a tendency to start creating blueprints at this point that, you know, to sort of retreat into utopian socialism and say, well, the working class needs to come together to change the mode of production in this way that I've mapped out exactly like this. And we'll have, you know, this color wallpaper and these sorts of machines. And but the reason I think you want to do that kind of move, or I have that tendency to want to do that kind of move, to start to dream up a positive vision of a new form of production, a new material basis for working people to relate to each other through. The reason you want to do that is it gives you more confidence to have at least a conception of what you're actually trying to create in a positive sense. And I'm not sure that that's avoidable.
No, I mean, one of the things I think, though, to get back to Draper, to the way Draper breaks this down, because he points out that the first period that you see dictatorship of the proletariat talking about is 1850 to 1852, and it's in regards to the failures of 1848. Mm-hmm. Marx then doesn't mention it for a long time. When he mentions it in these early forms, he uses it to talk about. So I'll actually read exactly what he says. He talks about bourgeois dictatorship and bourgeois terrorism interchangeably, and that this characterizes the rule of the bourgeois republic, and when it degenerates, it goes into a terroristic mode. So dictatorship here simply means like rule of. It doesn't even really mean, like, it doesn't even have a specific character.
It doesn't mean that temporary state of exception even?
Yeah, no, I mean, that when he talks about the bourgeois dictatorship, he's not talking about a state of exception. He's talking about the rule of. And so their dictatorship just means the monopoly of force and the ability to wield law. Okay.
Let me ask you a question that I think we've gone over before. But, you know, in the period between right around 1848 and after, to what extent did Marxists and socialists conceive of the bourgeois as their primary enemy?
I think before 1848, they don't.
Right.
I think particularly after things go so south in France and they see the bourgeois side with the rule of order, and they see they actually see to maintain bourgeois rule, degenerations back to, you know, against all the things that they promoted. They start seeing the bourgeois as the primary enemy, but this actually reverses again at the end of the First International after Marx's death, because they start seeing the need for, you know, the creation of productive forces, and thus the bourgeois retain, you know, go back to having a historical role. And this again flips again by the Second International. The ambivalence is because, like, the bourgeois are the people who set up the society to which they oppose. That society was being set up in front of them. I mean, that's the thing that we, like, keep on emphasizing. Like, right. It was not them looking at a already existing bourgeois society. The only bourgeois society that they recognized as fully bourgeoisified, and it still had medieval and feudal elements to it. I mean, like we've talked about before, land reform only partially happened in England because of this.
Right, but it was England, and that was the example of the bourgeois society.
Right.
Yeah.
So like when they talk about bourgeois dictatorship, they're seeing the rules being changed underneath their feet constantly. I mean, but they're still kind of ambivalent about it because the establishment of bourgeois republics are something that they still hold into, like, well into the First International. We've talked about that too. Like the Garibaldiists and stuff were still in the International. What's interesting about this, though, is one of the things Marx makes pretty clear pretty early on is he talks about, you know, he talks about how Louis Blanqui really represents the proletarian interest, but he opposes Blanqui's want for a minority of the proletariat to rule as a faction. He also opposes this in Bakunin, and he you know, would have opposed it in Babeuf even before Blanqui. He would laugh at the fact that LeBlanc would use Blanqui to kind of scare the bourgeois into, but, you know, and so he respected Blanqui, but he did not think that was the right way to go. So right. Blanqui's insurrectionary tactics are kind of accepted, but this idea that a minority of the proletariat need to rule instantly is rejected outright. So you see that's so the clarification of the dictatorship of the proletariat is in its early phases very clearly a separation from the dictatorship for the proletariat or as a representation of the proletariat. Now, people might have logical problems with like a whole class ruling. What does that mean? Well, in their case, it means democracy from that class.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, the idea is that there won't be everyone will be in a sense, everyone will be a worker.
Mm-hmm.
So to worry about other classes not being represented in a socialist society is, I think, to make a mistake. By everyone being a worker, that means in the transformation of the mode of production, that would mean that there would be no proletariat class or working class that's exploited as we know it now.
Right. So what's interesting is like when Marx really starts talking about the dictatorship of the proletariat, he is talking out specifically in the context of Blanc's attempt at, you know, an educational dictatorship and then Blanqui's minority faction rule. And I mean, here's what he says.
I mean, but just to point something out, that is so far away from Lenin's conception of it, right? These earlier socialists.
Well, I don't actually know that it's got that far from Lenin's conception of it. I think Lenin's conception of it is just that Lenin thinks the state form has to hold on for longer. Like he thinks this
trend. But these forms where you think that you need an educational apparatus that's called the dictatorship of the proletariat in order to get the workers into condition where they can even vote is not as advanced as Lenin's conception of the dictatorship of the proletariat, which would provide force to suppress the bourgeoisie during.
I would agree with that. Yes. But I just want to read what he says. So the dictatorship of the proletariat is a declaration of the permanence of the revolution, the class dictatorship of the proletariat as a necessary transit point to the abolition of class distinctions generally. All right. So this is how we know, one, he is referring to the dictatorship just as rule, but two, he's also pointing to it as a state of exception that allows for the removal of class altogether through the socialization of, and in what order you can debate, because it's debated all throughout Marxism, but the socialization of first the state, the state and the means of production, and then, you know, society in general. And talking about the socialization of society seems redundant, but Mark.
I know, but yeah, right. I know. I mean, it is the formation of a society, class of society. Throws in, what do we demand? What do we do of the demand for branded commodity?
Why does branded commodity is created by the demand for branded commodity is created by advertising, and advertising would not be necessary if you're producing for need.
I had a shit post on Facebook where I thought under fully automated luxury communism, there might be something like advertising left. It just wouldn't be advertising commodities. It would be advertising opportunities in the realm of production. People would still go, you know, say, hey, come try out my thing, and this is happening over here, and try to convince
masses of people, and masses of people might participate in creating propaganda for their projects in a free society to persuade.
Right. The point was that we wouldn't just revert to, we wouldn't be just become robots, utterly rational. We would have all sorts of.
No, I mean, in socialist transition societies, there were brands. I mean,
wouldn't want to live in a socialist society if I couldn't drink Coca-Cola. I want people to take that, clip that out, throw that around.
But one of the things I do worry about with that is particularly after the quasi-liberalization of the USSR was that so much of the Eastern Bloc just started aping capitalist branding and stuff to kind of, we can do the same thing, but in a slightly different way. Also, we're going to give cybernetics to the capitalists and they're going to do it better than we do it.
At that point, though, it was clear that the project for what we would call socialism was dead already, that we were only talking about some form of bourgeois society. And that isn't by their own admission,
Right. So what's interesting to me, okay, so the second period of the mission of the dictatorship of the proletariat is in 1871 to 1875, and that's when Marx actually makes it a little bit clearer what he means, because it's about the Communards.
Yeah.
But then there's a third period that Draper thinks is super important, and that is 1875. But Engels alone is writing about it, mm-hmm. and it's to distinguish himself from Plekhanov and some of the other social democrats, and to insist that the dictatorship of the proletariat exists in something like a democratic republic. And so that's interesting. That's to me kind of one of the most clarifying things is that Engels at least thought that the dictatorship of the proletariat was where, was still, at least within the proletariat itself, democratic and republican, even though it seems a little bit unclear to me whether Marx thought the dictatorship of the proletariat was direct or indirectly democratic. That's not really stated. But that it's necessary because without it, when one of the things that basically both, when you read, the postmortems by Bakunin and Marx, one of the things they agree on is the Communards, for all their insurrectionary, actually played by the rules too much, and got themselves killed for it. So the suspension of rules, the state of exception is, to use Smithian terms, as much as I hate it, is necessary, even if your goal is the abolition of the state itself. And one of the things that he would, one of the things that Marx, Bakunin would talk about how this withering away would leave the state forever and all this. But Marx would just point out, look, you want to run anarchism as a dictatorship of a small group of anarchist insurrectionary activists. There is no democratic accountability in that. It's basically ruled by terror cell. Mm-hmm. And so, that insistence that not only is it withering away, but that withering away has to have large-scale, broad support, buy-in, and input from all the people of the class in question. And other classes are not necessarily, marked out to be removed or excluded. They just have to be led by the class that has the interest in abolishing property altogether. Mm-hmm. The definition of proletariat is not working class. Working class is in some ways fudging a bit. Working class includes all people who are dependent on the wage fund. But the proletariat is specifically the propertyless and those without capital.
I would say it's people without productive property beyond their own self.
Right. Well, I mean, for example, if
I think you can own a house and still be working class.
Right. Well,
as long as you don't have enough land to grow enough crops to create commodities for exchange.
Right. We don't have subsistence peasantry anymore. All right.
Right. Someone asked a question here. What do you do if parts of the proletariat are too in conflict with one another and they can't exert this unified authority? You don't have a revolution.
Yeah, you don't have a revolution. You actually have, Actually, there's a lot to break down in there. One is one of the things about the political form of the political formation of the proletariat as a political class, as opposed to like just a class that exists under capital, mm-hmm. is that its politicization organization gives it a means to work out its internal conflicts and differing interests, which Marx realized existed. It was not like two. I think you do have to do. I mean, I do think there's been developments of capital in such a way that like. There's a bunch of ways to talk about this. I know ML Worldview in the chat is talking about it as a salutariat, but you know, about parts of the working class and strata close to the working class or people who are kind of dependent on the wage form, but not really, that you have to deal with, you know, too. They're not all petty bourgeois. That's often used, but that's really not actually what's going on there. Mm-hmm. So you have to coalesce around that. And I think one of the things that maybe Marxists have historically underestimated in action, you know, we always talk about actually existing socialism. Let's talk about actually existing capitalism is that there are enough different interests within the working class to keep it divided a lot of the time, particularly in later forms of capital.
This sets up what I want to talk to you about next. And we'll probably do it on another live stream that will go on the Patreon more extensively, but I do want to bring it up now before we finally really encourage questions and super chats and put questions most significantly. But here's what I want to say is that it seems to me that if you, oh, now don't you hate it when your thought leaves you? I know I can get it back. Okay. It has to do with Grossman, right? Mm-hmm. It has to do with understanding the proletariat as a political force aimed at particular kind of social transformation rather than simply a party that wants to take power within capitalism. It's the bringing together of the proletariat as this transformational force that would want to first and foremost change their own lives, change the way they produce things, make sure that people get what they need, right? That would be the first like ground floor level aim of a proletariat revolution, I think, would be to make sure that people in your community and people around the world are getting what they need. Like overcoming famine might be a major goal for a proletariat revolution. And this connects to Grossman and his crisis theory, because he thought that the terminal crisis of capitalism wasn't guaranteed to bring on socialism, but that it created situations for proletariat revolution that could be opportunities for revolution, create revolutionary moments, these moments of crisis.
Right.
Because it would overcome the way that the working class was divided. It would force the mass of the working class would be so immiserated and that the conflict would be clear that it was between the bourgeois Z and the property owners and the working class.
Yeah, so I'm super influenced by Grossman, but one of the things that's always haunted me is like that prediction has never happened. The immiseration clarity doesn't seem to be what actually plays out. And when you look at the biggest period of immiseration in the 20th century is the period during the rise of fascism, and it's when the workers' movements as a whole are the most disunified. Often you have the communist and the socialist taking positions and then flipping positions where they exactly, like they literally do a 180 to each other.
Am I just stating the immiseration thesis, or do I have a different, I mean, isn't there something more to this than just poverty? It's not so much just that it's poverty, no, it's also
the crisis of, now, what's unclear to me is if Grossman actually thought that this was necessary. And I think one of the reasons why he's been one of the understudied people at the Frankfurt School is it clearly wasn't necessary. One of the things the Frankfurt School responded to Grossman, and Grossman was part of the only economist, really, the only important economist out of the Frankfurt School.
Yeah.
That they were responding to is that Grossman's thesis predicted the proletarian revolution, and what they got was fascism.
Yeah, but it didn't, okay, again, it didn't.
It didn't necessitate it in the like automatist way that say high period Stalinism said it would.
Right. No, it just said that there were moments which offered an opportunity or a revolutionary situation was possible, and that that would be during major crises. Now, what would you need in those moments? It wouldn't just be starvation or material struggle or a sense of precarity. It would be the obvious conflict arising between, basically it would start out around wages, you know, the conflict being between the needs of capital to try to squeeze the wages down as much as possible in order to sustain profitability, and the needs of the working class. When the capitalist class could no longer reproduce itself and pay out anything like a living wage, and whether with state assistance, you know, forget about state assistance here, because the idea would be that that wouldn't be possible either, right? That when that was no longer possible, then the conflict would clearly be between the needs of workers and the needs of capital itself. And now, I guess what I'd need to read more Grossman to find out is if he understood how the role of nations would play out and to mitigate that. Like the fact that you could, rather than have it be a global understanding that the workers were at war with capital overall, it could be perceived as a war between national empires and therefore between workers as well. I think
but you have to look at the divided and uneven totality elements of that, right? Mm-hmm. So right. Like capitalism is a system that exists both within nations and is external to nations. But nations are, you know, nation states. I should be specific here. Mm-hmm. Nation states are a capitalist formation. While not all capitalist countries use the bourgeois republican nation state or the bourgeois parliamentary republic, most of them do. And like, it does seem to mitigate where crises can move around, but there are still world crises. But what, you know, Grossman and to some degrees Mandel and some other people seem to think that, like, that there's no way out of you know, the overproduction problem. But it does seem like capitalism finds a way, if not to actually destroy the product through wars, which I don't think are, like, I don't have this conspiracy that, like, oh, the capitalists want wars. They actually don't. But it does reset things pretty conveniently.
No, the capitalists don't. I mean, look, the capitalists don't want to drive down the rate of profit.
Right.
They do want innovation. Right. And they do want to do the things that drive down the rate of profit. They don't want war either, but they do want to shuffle off their own national debt, which is actually, you know, truly a debt of the capitalist class within their country originally, which might have been financialized and then taken up by the state. They do want to shuffle that off onto their neighbors, if at all possible. They don't want war.
Right.
But they do want not to be responsible for immiserating their own population and losing power.
Right.
Right.
So, you know, one way to destroy capital is planned obsolescence, as someone in the chat says, and that's not to be underestimated. And another way is it is financialization, because you can hide and actually destroy capital through revaluations. Revaluation schemes that are disconnected from what we as Marxists would call proper value.
Can you do that without driving down investment in productive activity and without creating unemployment?
No.
Right.
That's why all capitalist nations like have acceptable levels of unemployment.
But the problem when you have true overproduction, or when you have an overvaluation of constant capital, when the running of capital is too expensive, and for a good profit rate to be established or maintained, the problem with that is that devaluation will lead to really massive unemployment. It won't just be in, you know, one quiet corner over here or over there, but it will. That's when you have a general crisis. So the idea is that there are countervailing tendencies that would include devaluation of different sectors, but eventually, constant capital is going to be so expensive overall, the it will be built up so much that you will have a general crisis, and not just in one country.
No, I think that the things that we have to deal with is the fact that there are more than two classes at play here, and they can also obscure this. Classically speaking, fascism was a coalition of some elements of workers, but it's mostly actually petty bourgeoisie and like inefficient businesses. And the promise was to save the inefficient businesses from mass capital. Weirdly, it sounds a lot like progressivism in the United States does, unfortunately. Mm. But fascism actually ends up dependent upon the very mass corporate capitalism that it's supposedly fighting. And so that not being factored in does...
Keep going. I'm sorry.
Does really kind of distort things. Okay.
You mentioned the Platypus Affiliated Society and their view on the dictatorship of the proletariat. What do you think about the work critique of the dictatorship of the proletariat? Well, I've interviewed some of the members
of the work critique school. I mean, they had a particular journal that they were attached to, and I forget the name of it. It might have been, I don't think it was Crisis, it was something else. But and I was not convinced that they overcame the notion of the dictatorship of the proletariat that we were kicking around as a temporary state of exception that would actually be the beginning of the process of withering away of the state under proletariat control. As you know, that I don't think that they could, that their critique of the dictatorship of the proletariat was that different from Nick Rogers.
Right. No. I think
that they state it as if it is something more than that. I think they tend towards kind of a rhetorical stance of anarchism, but maybe I'm wrong because it was, you know, they were German and I was speaking in English. They were speaking English, and maybe I lost something in the translation, but they definitely seemed very much of a certain kind of, well, they seemed like they were products of the new left.
Right.
Use work critique to abandon the proletariat to some degree. And yeah. I'm not sure why that's justifiable. It makes me want to go back to Moshe Pistone and look at what he says.
To get into my thoughts on some of this stuff a little bit more clearly, one of the things I think you do have to deal with Grossman and, you know, the transition to the to proletarian control is, I think that early Marxists tended to maybe even more than Marx underestimate the way these other classes can muck up the game. And the reason why Marx was more aware of it is because peasants in the countryside and agrarian labor in the countryside in France was a damn wild card during the revolution, which, you know, at first supported the Ancien regime, then supported the Party of Order, then supported the Bonapartists. It did have left tendencies occasionally when it was getting screwed by the very parties it was putting into power. Like,
Derek, where do you think that kind of class is today that would muck up efforts to develop a proletariat revolutionary struggle or party, or where would the exceptions be in terms of class during a crisis and economic?
Those dependent on the state. So inefficient businesses who need the state to save it, parts of state functionaries who, while they're important to the circuit of capital and might be considered working class, are not dependent on the general profit base, but are dependent on the profit base indirectly through the tax base. They are still dependent on the profit base, but like they're two steps removed. They can go in either direction. And sometimes they're going to seem like the more radical workers because they have more protections and their ability to move around is greater. And right now the state's been in weirdly austere form. If you look at the last 10 years,
it's been in neoliberalism is somewhat austere.
Right. I mean, you can talk about the managerial stratus, we have no idea where, like, those some of them clearly lie with the bourgeoisie. Others can go all over the place.
Well, I've noticed it, and I've said this to you a few times probably, but I've noticed that the left, the American left, mm-hmm. response to the recent bailout has been to decry the way it concentrates capital in the hands of a few corporations.
Right. The way
it undermines small business.
Which was the fascist complaint in the 20s.
Well, my thought about it is that, you know, we should welcome the former small business owners into the working class and get them to help us organize for wage.
Proletarianization. I mean, in some ways, like, petty bourgeois are like a working class adjacent. They're often poor. Mm-hmm. Honestly. Their margins are very thin. They work in fields that are inefficient or have very low profit margins. I mean, one of the things about, like, right now, when we talked about the reactionaryism of the petite bourgeoisie, which are very small business owners, that you do actually have to feel for them, because, like,
The woman who owns a tanning salon down the street that now is out of business, you know, I feel like she's my class enemy, and I'm not going to be satisfied until she's strung up by the intestines of a priest, you know? No, I don't mean that. I don't mean that at all.
There are days where I say that about you, Doug. But, like,
I know that. I know that. But that's just your own, you know, class of barn. What?
In all honesty, though, like, I think like it's reactionary. But the petite bourgeois can go in a lot of different ways. Like, bodega owners tend to be largely sympathetic with the working class. I'm not always sympathetic into saving them, but, like, you know, like, but I also realize if you completely alienate them, like, they're a class base for really scary politics historically. Like, if you want things that you don't think can exist, watch where the petite bourgeois go. And the other thing is management. Management has a lot of power right now. And also there's a lot of hatred towards them. And frankly, there's a lot more hatred towards management than towards capital.
No, yeah. But that is, I mean, that's all.
There's psychological dominions into that, right?
Yeah. I mean, that's who you see. That's who you know. If you hate your boss, you hate management.
Right.
No one, when I worked at Comcast, people hated their immediate supervisors and the people above them. They didn't hate the CEO of Comcast.
When I worked for Gecko Insurance Company, which I will, you know, use by its incorrect name, mm-hmm. I loved Uncle Warren and liked my immediate boss, but all those bosses in the middle.
Yeah. Well, I just think that, you know, as we go into the economic crisis, what we should be talking about is where the opportunities are. And I don't think the opportunities for working class struggle, let's call it that, you know, I'll refrain myself from calling for revolution. Mm-hmm. I think the opportunities for working class struggle lie in the direction of, you know, the Amazon workers, the essential workers who are out on strike right now, and then also will lie in the direction of the unemployed workers when the lockdown is lifted and the struggle for a continuation of unemployment insurance, but also something like guaranteed work guarantees, you know, full employment. Those are the demands that should be made after.
I think you will see the proletarianization in a bad way for them and for me, of a lot of the middle tier professions. Like, because despite the fact, you know, MMT, gun and butter politics, that I don't think the state can actually perpetually inflate its way from an international multi-market crisis. Like,
no, I don't either. And I think that
currencies are,
I think that what we're going to be up against is not a struggle between, you know, left-wing wannabe union organizers, say, and Trumpers. I think what we're going to be facing is, you know, a struggle for working class power within our own country, if, you know, in the United States for us, and a push for war eventually. I think that that's
what we're headed for.
I don't know that the push for war is going to be in the United States.
Well, maybe not.
I mean, like, one of the things that you see right now is Xi-India tensions going off scale. So, like, maybe we won't need to have the war here. I mean, one of the things.
Yeah.
To be super cynical and gross mini about it, like, but this is also where, like, you know me, I don't hate game theory, and I'm one of the weirdo Marxists who doesn't, but where I think you do have to look at, like, focusing on, like, you have to focus on the international answer to this, not just the national one, mm-hmm. because the national one actually will make, like, certain kinds of binds. Like, you know, for all the talk of Red Brown and all of everybody calling everybody else a Strasserite that you hear these days, which seems...
Does everyone get called that, or is it just me?
I think we all get called that once or another.
I get called that, like, every freaking day on...
Well, the funny thing is, like, 10 years ago, I actually met Strasserites on the internet, and now I don't. So, like...
They've driven us all underground.
but I do think... I do think what we're going to see is some real, real issues, not just with the U.S. in war, but you're going to see the breakdowns of, like, there's tensions between India and China. BRICS is all at odds with itself. Like, what we used to call the BRICS coalition was going to be the great counter-hegemonic power to the hegemony of the Western
NATO.
Yeah, to NATO. That's at odds right now with itself in a way that we have not seen. There's very real chances of war there because also some of these economies are now experiencing, you know, we're kind of late in the capitalist cycle, but some of these other economies that some people claim are not capitalist are now experiencing business cycles in a very real way that they have not done yet. And so we're likely to see the same kinds of spasmodic, like, stateswomanship that you see in, you know, the capitalist West, historically speaking, and that can be weird. But I do think that's why there's a march towards aggression in the United States. I don't know that there's a march towards war yet.
No, not yet. I'm just sort of, look, this is my dark nightmare. I don't have good, I just know that that would be a way for the United States to handle its problems fiscally is to try to shuffle off the problem onto China and India and Europe, even, you know, I don't know. This is an absolute fact. I can't walk through all the pieces of it, you know, but I think that is the case. That's actually something that I want to understand better as the weeks go on here before, while we have time left on Earth.
Well, I mean, I do think we're going to see it. There's going to be a call for all kinds of ways of demeaning value. I mean, including attempts to do it through MMT. I mean, MMT, I don't even know what it means anymore because it means everything from, like, a works program to, like, just printing money. It's descriptive and non-descriptive. Like, I don't know. Like, you know, when the MMTers do that thing where they'll state the weak form that I agree with. Of course, the state can't run out of money when it's not pegged to anything, you know, we can operate capitalism in a more equitable way by sucking up liquidity through tax policy and, like, you know what I mean? But I think we're going to see a lot of that because that's going to be appealing as these binds get there. I mean, one of the things that I think people are missing is like there's a fear that incurred at the beginning of this COVID stuff that people missed where market bonds and gold for at least 2 days all went down together. That's not supposed to happen. Right. And, like, now the stock market's back up relative to itself and bonds are stabilizing. But that fear is because, like, if that happens, that means stuff like MMT won't work.
Here's a question from the audience here. Let's see if I can get it to show. Would you consider the
PRK, a nation state. I sometimes describe them as an indigenous nation state to people. Not sure how accurate that is.
The Democratic People's Republic of Korea. In so much that the Korean people are indigenous to the Korean Peninsula, which if they are, they're actually indigenous to more than either of the two Koreas. You know, there's whole areas of China that are and have been.
Well, the question is, first, is it a nation state? I would just say
yes. It is a state that has a single nation. It doesn't represent anyone else. It's actually very hard for other people to get membership. Is it a state? Yes. Are Koreans a nation? Do they have a language? Do they have a historical tradition of autonomous self-rule? Yes. Is it indigenous to the area? I mean, ish. They probably.
Well, they might claim that, though. That would be their claim, wouldn't it?
Right.
Wouldn't it be central claim to the North Korean identity?
Yeah, and anthropologically speaking, I think they have some legitimacy to at least 7,000 years in the area, which is more than most people have to anywhere. So I'll give it to them. Does that matter? Should I support them because they're an indigenous nation? Meh. No. Do I want them to be run over by Western imperialists? No. It's like there are other answers to things, right? But I guess if you want...
Yes. I was so relieved that Kim Jong-un was as well. So, yeah. So, all right.
I don't want war between the Koreas. That's good.
Yeah. So, let's see. Are there any more questions from the audience?
There's a lot of questions, but they're all over the place. Yeah.
It's not a question, but Doug is a stress right because he said he said wannabe unionizers, and I felt attacked.
Oh, fair.
Yeah. It's Elliot.
MMT equal magic money tree.
Yeah, I like
that. Markets get warped in crisis. People have to liquidate assets to cover payments and marginal costs. Yes, that's kind of duh. How close do we keep getting going at it with Iran is more concerning to me there. I don't know. I don't know either. Iran's one of those calculations where it looks superficial, like it'd be another one of those petty wars that we could just, you know, to be super cynical, kill a bunch of people who don't look like us, except that it wouldn't be as easy with Iran, and considering how much like Iraq and Afghanistan have been a pain in the side, once you get past the initial destruction period and try to build or stabilize the region, Iran would be, I don't even want to think about.
So someone asked, how do you feel about Keith Woods, Borzoi, and other alt-right promoting you guys? I don't know who Keith Woods is. Do you know who he is?
Nope.
Borzoi, I don't know who that is either. Do you know?
No.
I could Google this.
Other alt-right promoting you guys?
If alt-right people are promoting me, I don't like that, I guess. But I know Richard Spencer has promoted like Zizek in the past. Right. That doesn't change my attitude about Zizek or Richard Spencer. Do I think it's a smart tactic for Richard Spencer to point his fan base, his own fan base, whoever they might be, at Zizek? Probably not, but it might, unless it makes people on the left ignore Zizek. I mean, I'm not sure what he's thinking. Frankly, I don't know. What do you think about that kind of stuff when alt-right people pick out a couple of Marxists to claim that they like them?
It's a historical tradition that goes all the way back to Mussolini. I mean, like.
Well, what has it meant historically then? Has it been done?
Because, you know, most fascism, you know, despite what we talked about its petty bourgeois character, its leadership does tend to be jaded, failed socialists. That's not its class base, but that is its leadership. That is its leadership cadre.
Well, a failed socialist isn't a class. So.
Right. It's not. It's an ideological tendency. So, right. And honestly, Richard Spencer he's like a soft leftist for white people. I mean,
he's a what?
He's a soft leftist for white people only.
Soft leftist?
Soft leftist. Like he thinks he likes social redistribution policies and like social welfare and stuff like that. I said, you should put scare quotes around.
Yeah, yeah. Bigger scare quotes around leftist right. there. Yeah, yeah. I mean, redistributionist policies are not the definition of what it means to be on the left.
No, I mean, frankly, neither is like I've pointed out many times, Schachtism and Chartism both have direct relationships to fascism, but they sound like Keynesianism and modern monetary theory. Mm-hmm. Boys of Boston. I mean, we just can't like we can't control who's gonna like us, and I'm not always comfortable with it.
Let's see.
They promoted
your follow up had Keith Woods on this morning, and they promoted you guys for your critique of Zizek and Foucault. Oh, look, this guy's picture is that mass murderer, Dylan something. So I'm not trying to tone police or limit your aesthetic, but that's a giveaway to me that maybe I shouldn't be taking you as seriously as I have been.
Ed Duchius, maybe you guys should have more conversations with actual third positionists. It's funny that you mentioned that.
Who would you pick as a third positionist to take apart sometime?
I would like to not take apart third position. I mean, if you want to discuss the Marxist reaction to fascism historically, I'm more than willing to do that.
What about Dugin? I mean, people do bring up like.
Well, Dugin's not a third positionist. He's a fourth positionist, but yes.
Because I feel like, maybe once it would be worthwhile to go through one of these people's work and say, look, here's their inconsistency, here's where they're wrong. I mean, you can start with anytime they're race reductionist, right? But mm-hmm. I mean, go from there. So why don't we end this broadcast on that note? I wouldn't mind doing Dugin talking about Dugin sometime, even though I know he's a frightening figure. I don't think that we should not talk about.
Well, I mean, I talk about, I go on other podcasts and talk about far right stuff. I know it pretty well. I mean, if you wanted to engage theoretically with a far rightist, which is not the purview of this show.
No, it's not what we would do on this show.
But yeah, I would look at Giovanni Gentile and the classical fascists who were praised by Lenin and then see how they deviated from that.
Yeah. All right. We should take a look at that. All right. So I'm going to run our Pop the Left credits. Stick around though, because we'll figure out what we're going to do next.
Okay.
I'm talking. This is pop.